So the theme that I've been reflecting on a fair amount this last week is the theme of energy or effort or strength. And the questions for today is, what is the relationship of effort or energy or strength or power and path of meditation or Buddhist spiritual path? And is there something that's contrary or problematic about emphasizing effort or energy or power when meditation seemingly, according to the rhetoric, is about being calm and accepting and peaceful? And do they work together or are they contrary to each other? I believe some people see them as being contrary, and it's an idea that being peaceful or calm or accepting as part of meditation practice lends to a certain passivity in certain people, kind of idea that meditation is a kind of a passive thing, and sometimes people, I think, undermine their own energy or effort or power because they think that it's supposed to be about, you know, being really peaceful and calm. In the discussion about what happens in meditation, there's a variety of different inner factors, mental factors, psychological factors that come into play when people meditate. And whenever someone says that meditation is about one thing, concentration, or it's about mindfulness, or it's about, you know, peace or calm, as soon as someone reduces it to one thing, you should always in your mind say, you know, what's being left out? Because there are actually a lot of different factors that come into play in meditation, psychological factors. And those factors need to come into certain balance with each other. And very broadly, some of the factors are divided into two groups, into those groups which are arouse energy, and those which are calming. And those two groups need to be in balance with each other. And if a person is too calm, too concentrated, then they need to apply the arousing factors to get more energy going. If a person is too calm or too peaceful or too kind of lethargic, then a person needs to bring up the arousing factors. Did I do that right? I feel like did I say it wrong? I said it twice. Okay. So if the person is too energized, they need to have the calming factors. If the person is too calm, they need to have the energizing factors. Did I get it right this time? Well, at least I caught it. There's some mindfulness here. And so these two categories, the arousing and the calming factors, need to be in balance. So what I'd like to do today is to emphasize the arousing factors out of energy and power. And I'm going to leave out, in a sense, the calming factors. But in your mind, just remember that it goes together. For attaining the deep peace that is awakening or freedom, that peace is not a peace that is absent of energy. There's vitality there, even sense of power. The Buddha was sometimes likened or described as a bull, a bull among people. The kind of bull is a very powerful figure. Sometimes he was described as a naga. People who are enlightened are described as nagas. Nagas means serpent or snake. And as some of you know, in Indian kind of symbolism, a snake is often a symbol of the power energy of Kundalini, a very powerful kind of energy in the system. You find in the... It was actually a surprise for me when I started reading a lot the discourses of the Buddha, how much the language there is the language of making effort, being diligent, being vigilant, being ardent, being persistent, being motivated, being committed. All these language of effort and energy, very strong. There's also sometimes the language of being having a sense of urgency in practice. Urgency also has a sense of energy. You know, it's urgent. You got to do it now. The more dramatic image for that that's used throughout Buddhism, from the early tradition down to certainly in Zen tradition, is for a person to practice as if their hair is on fire. I don't know if it gives a good sense. I mean, it seems like, you know, some people, when their hair's on fire, they're a little bit, they lose their presence in mindfulness. They kind of, but a sense of urgency, like it's really important. In this regard, I like Sylvia Borstein's little story of when she was 14. She was being grumpy, or she was having a bad day at home, and she kind of attributed to her hormones as a 14-year-old, slamming doors and being angry. And a relative told her, "Oh, Sylvia, you know, you don't get to live this day over again." And that kind of sobered her up. Oh, I don't get to live this day over again. This day counts. And if I live the day one way, then, you know, I don't get to kind of do it again. That day is done. And that kind of gave her a sense of kind of healthy urgency, like, oh, it's important how I live this day. So the idea of urgency is very important in the tradition. Some sense of that our life is short, some sense that it's precious, it's important what we do, and that who knows when the end will come, or when we can no longer practice, or when the opportunities are not there. So while we have the opportunity, and we have the effort, the body to do it, let's do it. Let's do it. It's important. One of the things that gives energy or vitality or power to someone wanting to do spiritual practice is a strong sense of motivation. And there's a wide range of how motivated people can be. It isn't like, you know, that, you know, some people, depending on the circumstances of their life, have different kinds of motivations in practice. People who have tremendous suffering in their life sometimes will have a very powerful motivation to practice. It's been pointed out that a lot of the great religious leaders of humankind, a lot of them, not all of them by any means, but a number of them lost a parent early in life. And it happened to the Buddha, it happened to Zen Master Dogen, it happened to other people, that they lost a parent. And that loss of a parent perhaps is what gave them the sense of maybe the suffering or the sense of urgency that they really wanted to deal with fundamental issues of life and death. Some people don't do the kind of reflective work to really look at their motivation, what motivates their life, and decide, you know, to really decide for themselves what is going to be the primary motivation of their lives, the primary motivations. Are the motivations just inherited from society, from family, this is what your life should be about? Or has there been some deep reflection that, you know, about, you know, some priorities? And no, my life's going to be about something different than what my parents expected me to do, or society, or getting along easily or being comfortable in life. I've known people who've gone along comfortably in life for a long time, and then at some point in life, saying, wait a minute, I don't think I just want to be comfortable. I think maybe I'm wasting some potential that I have. There are other possibilities that I can do. I like a little quote that says, a ship is safe in the harbor, but that's not what ships were made to do. To stay in the harbor. So to really find a sense of motivation, I think, is one of the important aspects of any spiritual life. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't mean you have to have the motivation to become the next Buddha, or some great, you know, great accomplishment in the spiritual life. But even to have the motivation to sit every day, there has to be motivation. And some people will come to me and ask me or talk to me about how they find it really hard to sit every day. And sometimes we'll explore that. There's all kinds of reasons for that. But one of the reasons for that is that the motivation is not there. There's some motivation, but the motivation is not powerful enough that they're willing to put a lot of other things aside. That this is really important. I'm going to do this no matter what. Another thing that brings energy and effort vitality to people is the idea of confidence, having confidence. So it's one thing to be motivated, but to have a lot of confidence in the possibility of what you're motivated to do. That this is really worthwhile. That it's possible to develop oneself or to move towards freedom or to wake up. It's really possible. And to have confidence in that. To have confidence in the teachings or the path that goes in that direction. To have confidence in one's own ability to do that. If there's no confidence, that undercuts the motivation, it undercuts the energy, the vitality that's there. Yes, I can do that. I'm going to do this. I can do it. I think I'm a little bit embarrassed. Not embarrassed enough not to tell you. But when I it took me many months, I think it was like 8 months, I forget, 9 months, I believe, for me to get my visa to go to Burma. I was going to go to practice for the long term in Burma at a monastery there. And it took a long time to get that visa. And finally, I got the visa in the Burmese embassy in Bangkok. And I had my passport with a stamp, you know. It doesn't say meditation visa, but it was a category of visa. Only country in the world, I think, that has a category called meditation visa. And so I had this visa. So I walked out of the embassy in Bangkok, down the street in Bangkok, and I started skipping and dancing down the street, singing the song, "You can get it if you really want, but you got to try, try and try." This idea that I was going to try. I was really happy. I was delighted. I was really motivated for this. And I was going to, you know, I had a lot of confidence in, enough confidence in the possibility of following through on this. This is something that can be done. And I don't think there was anything unwholesome about skipping down the street or singing that song. You know, I was delighted. It felt really good. It felt energy and aliveness and vitality. And the desire, the motivation for spiritual practice is considered to be very helpful and wholesome motivation. Sometimes Buddhists will undermine themselves when they interpret Buddhist teachings as saying you should have no desire, because in a kind of unhelpful way, some people have translated the teaching of the Buddha to say that desire is the cause of suffering. It's not what he said. But when people say that, mistranslated, then it seems like, well, then I'm not supposed to have any desire, thank you. You know, and I'm supposed to be kind of self-effacing. Also, the teaching of not self in Buddhism, it lends itself to some idea, oh, I'm supposed to be self-effacing, you know, I don't count so much, you know, and I need to apologize for myself, and I can't, you know, I can't take a stand, I can't be here in an unapologetic way. One of the great delights in my practice has been my energy and my effort and my vitality. And there's something lovely to really be engaged and absorbed in activity that I love doing, that seems really important, and kind of be able to put all my energy into doing, this is what I'm going to do, completely. And to devote myself to that for a period of time. It was really lovely. I still love it. When I sit down to meditate, even sitting here with you, there's a kind of delight that I get. It's just kind of, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to have the effort, the energy. And there's a way in which effort begets effort at times. And I could feel it sitting with you, that a certain kind of vitality, aliveness gets born as I bring myself and apply myself in the present moment. So I see that there's two kinds of energy in practice, two general categories. One is the kind of energy that comes from applying oneself. And we need to apply yourself. We need to apply ourselves. We need to make some effort. We need to show up. And then the other effort doesn't come from applying ourselves or making effort, but is the kind of the energy that is, we can maybe define as vitality or an inner sense of power that just kind of courses through us, that sometimes is there, sometimes is not. If we're tired, it's not there. Or all kinds of reasons might not be there. But sometimes it's really there. You feel kind of powerful and filled with energy and aliveness. And that effort, that kind of the flowing through us and in us. And then when we apply ourselves, the application is informed or infused with the vitality that's there. If you try to apply yourself when you're really tired and drained, the application is not going to have much oomph. But if you feel some real vitality, then the application will have a much more juice in it, much more aliveness. So to have a sense of inner vitality, inner power, I think is one of the things that is very helpful in practice. Are people afraid of their power? I know some people are. There are some people who, as they go into society, and they're afraid of their power, because I had people tell me, I'm afraid I'm going to bowl people over. And the paradox is, most of the people who tell me this are people who are so self-effacing to begin with, so hesitant to begin with, so tentative to begin with, you can never imagine they're going to come show up in a way that's going to bulldoze people over. But yeah, I'm afraid I'm going to, you know, bulldoze people. Or somehow they're afraid of their power. And I think that if we're afraid of our power, again, it shortchanges us in using our own resources for being engaged in practice. The problem, of course, with having our own power is it can be misused. It can be with a sense of arrogance, with a sense of greed, with a sense of striving in some unhealthy way. It can be used in such a way that we kind of get blinded by the sense of power, the personal power, the inner power, vitality. And you're just kind of like kind of humming and going along. We're not really paying attention in a broad way. So that's why energy and power need to be balanced or helped by the other factors that come into play when people meditate. So, for example, mindfulness has to be there. So if the power goes into mindfulness, then it's a self-correcting system because you're paying attention and you notice where you're a little bit off. If the power is balanced with an emphasis on having equanimity or an emphasis on staying tranquil with that power. And that's one of the odd things about I found with meditation life is the way in which there can be tremendous power and tranquility at the same time. The two aren't antithetical to each other, but they can work together. And in fact, the deepest forms of tranquility that's available have a tremendous sense of vitality together with them, or aliveness or energy or something. When I was a college student, I was living in a household of other college students, and I had a good friend who, when I came home from the day at the university, he would be there usually, and he would be sprawled out on the couch. And I admired him because he was so laid back. This is great, and he's a little laid back. And it never occurred to me that I was supposed to be like that, but I remember kind of like, oh, that's nice. You know, he's so laid back. So there's kind of a little, you know, thought that went through my mind, idle thought. And then I went to the monastery and to Tassajara. And Tassajara has these wonderful hot springs. It's a resort during the summer, and people go there to resort and to use the hot springs. But in the wintertime, it's a very intensive Zen training monastery. But they still have the hot springs. And every day, there's a period of time to go use the baths. That's the time you would clean yourself. And in the late afternoon, they have this bath time, and you get to go into the hot tubs. And I noticed that when I first got there, in the first, I don't know how long, month or two, that I would go and luxuriate in the baths. And I would go and just relax. It was really lovely to be there in those baths. But after a couple of months there, I noticed that I stopped luxuriating. I would just go shower and go into the tubs to warm up. It was cold, just to warm up enough. And then I would get out and go continue with my day. And I thought, you know, what's that about? You know, I used to have this ability to relax in the baths, and now I'm not relaxing in it anymore. Am I getting kind of, you know, uptight or, you know, what's happening here? And so I kind of explored that a little bit. And what I found was that when I was luxuriating and resting and enjoying the baths, it was a compensation for being tense during the day. And so it was helping me to relax. And so part of the enjoyment came with just relaxing. After I'd been in the monastery for a couple of months, I wasn't getting tense anymore. You know, in the same way as I had been, I basically started to learn how to be in a relaxed mode throughout the day, you know, and practicing a lot and sitting a lot. And so there wasn't that need to compensate. And so I just went there, and matter-of-factly, I enjoyed taking the bath and showering and doing everything, but there was no need to linger there because it wasn't needed anymore as a compensation or as a correction, as a balancing for how I'd been in my daily life. And so there was a kind of a energy there that was very balanced, that didn't need balancing, but was already balanced. So my friend, who was relaxed in college, I realized, he was laid back because it was, for him, it was a compensation, because I saw how he lived his life otherwise, for running around like crazy during the day. And he came back and he kind of looked tired, and he just kind of was a couch potato. As you know, he was kind of laid back in a sense, but it was a compensatory laid backness. So when we talk about having energy and vitality, we're also talking about finding a way to have it so it's balanced. An interesting story, a friend of mine who went to her Zen teacher and described how busy she was. She did a lot of things. And you know, it can be kind of a contagious illness in our society. And her teacher said to her, "Oh, that's because you're lazy." You know, that caught her attention. Lazy? And so she went and thought about it. and thought about it, and she realized it was because she was lazy. Being busy was a way of not looking at herself deeply. It was a way of avoiding herself. She was lazy to do the spiritual work, the investigative work, of really facing up to herself and seeing what was going on, what was driving her. And so she was always busy because she didn't want to take that step back to look at herself. So the teacher called that laziness. So what is busy about? You know, if we're energetically busy and we find ourselves exhausted because of it, and we need to kind of, we need this pendulum to swing in the other direction, then I think we're not using our energy well. And there's a lot of ways in which people use their energy and it's draining. Being greedy and ambitious, being filled with self when we do it, so we're trying to kind of defend a self or build up a sense of self. To be very reactive in the world as we go through our lives. There's a lot of ways in which we are can often drain our energy. And so part of mindfulness is to look at what is the reactivity, what is the way we carry ourselves into the world that might affect the quality of the effort and energy we have. Is it energizing? Is it satisfying the energy? Or is the energy somehow off in one way or the other, too much or too little? In a wonderful, almost koan-like story, the Buddha, or teaching, the Buddha said, when you want to cross the river of suffering, you don't want to stand still, and you don't want to push ahead. But neither standing still nor pushing, but some kind of steadiness, some kind of relaxedness, perhaps, in the effort and the energy. Now, some people have a lot of energy in their practice, and sometimes it's a problem for them. They don't know how to handle it. Inner kind of energy, kind of feeling of like electricity sometimes coming through them and moving through them. And that can happen. And then part of practice is learning how to work with that and how to open to it and relax and so that the system, the body, is kind of a free channel for it and moves through us. Or to understand some of the dynamics of what triggers that kind of energy. Sometimes we need to relax when there's electricity in the system, and but to find what it is that needs to be relaxed so the energy can come into a balance again. I asked a friend of mine, a Buddhist teacher, this week about this topic of effort and energy. And he said, oh yeah, it's important. So how do you get it? How do you get good power and practice and energy? And he thought for a while and he said, oh, the only way I know how to do it is by interest, having interest. I think there are other ways also, but for him, interest was really key. So that's what really works for me. I bring a sense of interest and also a sense of playfulness in my practice. And I play around in there. You know, I play with my breath and try different things and see how it works. And that brings interest and it brings energy and effort. I'm curious about what goes on there. I look more deeply in what's happening. And that interest brings energy, awakens it. Sometimes getting enough exercise brings energy and effort. When I sat in my long retreats in Burma, I liked sitting a lot. And my teacher said, it was okay for you to sit a lot, but he said, he forbade me from sitting in meditation unless I first did walking meditation. So because I think he wanted me to have enough energy to make the sitting work. And I was kind of like so wanting to sit all the time. If you sit all the time, you become lethargic. So one way is to walk and do walking meditation. And there was a time, even when I practiced in daily life, that I get up in the morning and the first thing I do is walking meditation, and then I would sit. Because I found it kind of awoke a certain kind of vitality and alertness that was very helpful for the meditation, for the sitting. Then you might ask, well, that's all good, but what about having coffee instead? Coffee, you know, is maybe okay, but as the mind gets calmer and stiller and the system gets more sensitive, most people that I know find that the energy that comes from coffee or caffeine is agitating and is not really helpful for the deep settling, deep peacefulness that needs to be together with the energy when we practice. Another quality, an aspect of effort or energy or power that's very important in the tradition is persistence, is continuity. energetic mindfulness or continuous mindfulness, so that we're giving it the best effort that we can. There's a persistence, willing to keep it up. That's particularly important on retreats. One of the teachings on retreats is that the retreat practice develops very much dependent on the continuity of our best effort. We give the retreat the best effort we have, knowing that the best effort changes over the course of the day. That sometimes in the day we're tired and effort doesn't look very good, and other times we feel very, powerful and strong and clear and alert, and effort is very sharp. But the idea is to use the best effort we have throughout the day, and being gracious or equanimous about how the ups and downs of how much effort is available. But to give it the best effort that's available, that continuity is one of the things that builds the practice over the days and months and years a person might do it. So for someone practicing at home who are not on retreat, one of the ways of practicing, having persistence, is, for example, having a daily sitting practice. And to have the motivation, to have the energy, to have the commitment, to have the understanding, the confidence, this is really important. And then to have the persistence to follow through on that each day. And something happens when we sit there each day that doesn't happen if you sit once a week. We avail ourselves of our potential. We avail ourselves of power, of energy, that can be aroused and get born or get cultivated when there's persistence over time. So I brought this little statue that I have for you. It's kind of small maybe to see, but I'll describe what it is. It's a statue of the Buddha here, a little guy here, sitting on the coils of a snake and a naga. And then the head of the snake curves up above the Buddha, kind of like a cobra. It kind of flares out to the side. And he had this big face, big head here with its sharp teeth, and these flames coming up from the top. So it's, again, a symbol of power. And it comes from a story that when the Buddha was, right after he was enlightened, he sat there in his place for some time. I guess it rained. Maybe it was, this naga came and curled himself around the Buddha and then covered him over with his hood and kept him dry. But again, what we're finding here is symbolically this association of power with meditation. And you have this juxtaposition here of the Buddha sitting serenely and peacefully with this symbol of power and strength and fire at the same time. In the Satipatthana Sutta, the discourse on the Buddha's discourse, where he describes the practice that we do here at IMC, one of the ways that he instructs people to practice mindfulness is to do it with atapi. And atapi is sometimes translated into English as with ardency, being ardent. And but the word atapi is related to the Sanskrit or Indian word tapas, which has a meaning of a little bit of fire at times or energy. But also means ascetic practice, kind of very strong, powerful ascetic practice. The Buddha renounced ascetic practice, but he still felt it was very important to have atapi, to have this ardency, this strength of power, this persistence. Some people translate it as persistence, persistent energy. And not to be lazy or laid back, but to have a real sense of dedication and purpose, energy and aliveness in what we do. Where's the aliveness in the practice? So it's kind of an art form, learning how to work with the arousing and the calming factors in meditation. It requires a sense of investigation, of interest and curiosity and looking and experimenting and trying things out to see, what works, How do I arouse my effort, my energy? How do I have a healthy sense of vitality in meditation practice? When is effort too much? When do I need to kind of calm down more? When am I too calm? When am I getting lethargic? When am I falling asleep in meditation? And to look at all these things and to keep working on them until we come to a place where we feel really balanced and alive and present in some healthy way. That investigation is part of what supports mindfulness, feeds mindfulness. The last thing I'll say about energy is is to use kind of an analogy of when we wake up from a nap, for example. Not everyone has this experience. We wake up from a nap, and you feel really awake, really clearly awake. There are certain qualities that are present in that wakefulness that are you only notice if you're kind of directed to pay attention to it. Perhaps it's kind of like this clarity, this kind of. But there's probably some sense of energy in that sense of being awake. It's almost, you know, you don't maybe notice it because it's kind of invisible, but, you know, you're alive, you're clear, you're alert. That alertness has energy in it. It's not too much, it's not too little, but it's alive, it's alert. So that kind of points to the balance of energy, perhaps, as practice goes on. That at some point the effort, the alertness seems invisible, or seems you don't quite see it, but it's there. It's not too much, it's not too little, it's not distracting one from the practice, it's not absent from the practice, but it's there. Some people talk about the effort at some point being self-generating, a snowballing effect, that somehow the energy is just happening, the movement is happening, and it's not us doing it anymore. We don't have to apply ourselves in practice, but it begins working on itself. And I think that's one of the beautiful points in practice, is the point in practice where the application of effort that we have to make initially can fall away. And there's almost as if some effort is moving through us or doing itself within us. Maybe some of you had this experience, maybe doing some exercise regime, like running perhaps. And then the first few days of trying to run or jog, or the first 100 yards, it's like, you know, running with heavy weights on, you know, and the mind protests, and no way, I can't do this. And then at some point something clicks into gear, and the energy and effort is there, and becomes more effortless effort for a while. The analogy that's given is kind of like a bird that's going to set flight. And someone described this to me recently, of seeing some big bird, like a, I don't know what it was, an albatross, something really big, pelican maybe it was. And they have to run really fast on top of the water while they're flapping their wings. It's a lot of work. And then at some point they have enough lift, they can take off, and then it's really graceful and beautiful. So it can be the same way with the effort and practice. There are times when we have to do a lot of manual work. We have to apply ourselves, show up, apply ourselves, and then at some point something catches and we're flying. So don't be afraid of your power, and don't be oppressed by this talk. You know. So take from the talk what is useful for you in your life, and what's helpful, and if some of it's not helpful or not useful, just leave it here with me. I'll keep it. So thank you very much, and.